Good afternoon. You're here with Animal Voices. My name is Allart. In the studio with me are my co-hosts, Carl Loskin, and on sound, Alan Jensen. Today we have a very special guest. Peter Singer will be with us. Before we bring Peter on, I have an announcement to make. This weekend is the Taste of Health Veggie Food Fair that is put on by EarthSave every year. It is happening at the Croatian Cultural Center this Saturday, Sunday, the 29th and 30th. And it's Saturday 10:30 to 6, Sunday 10:30 to 5. The Croatian Cultural Center is at 16th and Commercial. There'll be speakers, book fair, cooking demonstrations, vendors, all kinds of things. It's a lot of fun. Admission is $7. If you're a member of EarthSave, you get in for free. There's some great speakers lined up. There's Jonathan Balcom, who's an animal behaviorist, and he's written a book called Pleasurable Kingdom. Dr. Doug Graham, who is a renowned raw food expert. Antonia Demas, who is a food educator, and she's introduced food, changed the food curriculum of over 1,000 schools in 28 states to get kids onto healthier diets. And so it's a great fair. I encourage you to get out and check it out. If you want more information about it, go to www.earthsave.ca. Peter Singer, he was born in Melbourne, Australia, and he was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He's taught at the University of Oxford, La Trobe University, and Monash University, and he's held several other visiting appointments. Since 1999, he's been Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University, and in addition, since 2005, Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne, attached to the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. He was the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics, and with Helga Kuz, founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. He is the co-founder of the Great Ape Project, an international effort to obtain basic rights for chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. He's also president of Animal Rights International, and in 2005, Time named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Peter Singer first became well known internationally after the publication of Animal Liberation, which came out in 1975 and has been revised a number of times for the changes that have gone on in the animal liberation movement. He's written a number of other books, and I think I'll just go through some of them because I think it tells you a lot about the man that we're going to interview. Some of his books are called Democracy and Disobedience, Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, Marx, Hegel, Animal Factories, The Reproduction Revolution, Should the Baby Live, How Are We to Live, Rethinking Life and Death, A Darwinian Left, One World, Pushing Time Away, The President of Good and Evil, and most recently, The Way We Eat. He has co-authored The Greens with Bob Brown, founder of the Australian Greens, and other books that he has edited or co-edited include Test Tube Babies, In Defense of Animals, Applied Ethics, Animal Rights and Human Obligations, Embryo Experimentation, A Companion to Ethics, The Great Ape Project, Ethics, A Companion to Bioethics, Bioethics and Anthology, and The Moral of the Story. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome you to the show, Peter.
Hi, Aunt. It's good to be with you.
Yes. Gosh, your resume is so impressive. It's just I had to stop. You know, I could go
on
for the whole hour.
Yeah, we could have gone on for a whole show, but I'm sure you would have lost all your listeners by then.
No, I don't think so. You're a fascinating man. Could you please define for our audience the difference between bioethics and ethics?
Bioethics is really a branch of ethics. It's the branch of ethics that is specifically to do with issues arising in connection with the biological sciences. It's often used really in a sort of narrow sense of biomedical ethics, so ethical issues relating to how doctors should deal with their patients or with new technologies, new scientific discoveries, like in genetics, questions about whether people should be able to select the genetics of their child, or the end of life, whether patients who are terminally ill and request assistance in dying should be able to get that. Those are, you know, the kind of questions that bioethics generally deals with.
And you have a new release come out that's come out called Stem Cell Research, The Ethical Issues, is that right?
Well, that's true, yes. It's not a book that I've written. It's a collection of articles that I've co-edited on that question, and I have contributed one essay with a co-author to that as well.
And what are your views about that? I understand that in Britain there's been a go-ahead on stem cell research with regards to the mixing of animal and human cells together.
Yes, I mean, you know, that sounds alarming, but really we're not talking about producing hybrids at all. We're talking about testing the growth of a nuclei, or perhaps testing the viability of a sperm by putting it in the egg of, you know, maybe a hamster or something like that. There's no possibility of any offspring emerging. I mean, these are species that couldn't possibly cross. You know, if you were talking about mixing a chimpanzee and a human egg, I guess there might be some possibility of that, but that's not what's contemplated here. It's not reproductive research.
And so then what is the value of it?
Well, there may be some scientific value in seeing, you know, you can, for example, if you want to know whether, let's say that there's a man who has had trouble having a child, right? So you want to diagnose the cause of the infertility in a couple. There may be something unusual with a man's sperm, so it may be possible to observe that in an egg of another species to see what's happening. There are sort of technical advantages in using animal eggs, for example, in these circumstances. It's a large area, and I'm not really on top of all of the details, but there are ways of discovering things that we couldn't discover otherwise.
And how do you feel about animal research in other respects, you know, testing of products on animals or using them for medical experiments?
Well, the problem with the practice, as indeed with all of the ways in which we interact with animals, is that we don't regard the animals as really having, interests of their own that we weigh alongside ours. So we tend to use them as if they were just things that we could order up as tools for research, as I called it in one chapter of Animal Liberation. A scientist might walk into a lab on Monday morning and say, well, for the research that I'm doing, I need to have, a certain number of test tubes, and I need this equipment and that, and I also need 200 rats or something of that sort. And they're just all ordered up as if they were pieces of equipment, really. And obviously there's a difference. The rats are sentient beings. They can feel pain, they can enjoy their lives, live lives well or live lives badly, they want to have relationships with others of their species, so it's completely different, but very often this is not really taken into account when someone will say, well, this is an experiment that we can run on animals.
Do you think that a lot of this, the attitude towards this, is related to the way people eat if they have a meat-based diet?
Absolutely. I think that's fundamental to the whole of our attitudes to animals. that because we eat them, or most people eat them on a daily basis, they become things to us. They become something that produces meat or eggs or milk. It's a kind of a machine or a tool, and it's very difficult to take seriously the interest of chickens, say, if what you're doing is you're just going to the supermarket and you're just picking up a frozen chicken and you're throwing it into your supermarket trolley and it costs a few dollars. You can't really think, say, you know, that was a bird who was living, that felt something, that had experiences, that could have had a good life, but probably actually had a miserable life because it was probably a factory farm bird confined indoors all its life. I think that really lies at the base of all of our attitudes to animals.
And it's interesting that with the story about the dog fighting with Michael Vick that's come up, people get so outraged about what's happened to dogs or the treatment of dogs, and yet this ongoing thing with the factory farms that they don't give a thought to. But when it's my animal, or there's an empathy towards my possession, my property, my dog, your dog, if we understand that, it's quite different.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. For one thing, you know, dogs are kind of privileged because at least in this society we don't eat them, and we do have them as companions. So we get to know them as individuals, we get to appreciate they have individual personalities, they obviously want things, they can obviously be miserable, not just, you know, through physical pain, but they can be humiliated or something like that. And we realize, you know, how complicated beings they are. But generally most of us don't think of this, say, about pigs, because we don't interact with pigs on a daily basis. And we do eat them, and most of the pigs in the United States and Canada are now locked up indoors all year round. And we never really even see most of them. And, so the attitude is totally different. So we get incredibly upset at what Michael Vick did to a few dogs. And, you know, I'm not for a moment, of course, condoning what he did. I think it was horrible. But, really we're talking about a handful of animals as against millions or hundreds of millions of farm animals, in fact, billions, including the chickens, to whom, you know, very frequently worse things will happen all the time. And yet, you know, nobody gets indicted, nobody gets charged with criminal offences, because they're inflicting pain and suffering on these pigs or chicken or cows or whatever else it might be.
And even with regards to the penalties that Michael Vick may be facing, it seems like they're only going to throw maybe 18 months at him, a year, something like that, which seems not sufficient for the kind of horrendous murder that he's committed against these dogs. And what does that say with regards to our attitudes to animals in general if he only gets 12 to 18 months?
Well, you say only, but in fact, you know, for anyone to go to prison at all for an animal-related cruelty offence is quite unusual. Had a farmer done something quite horrible, you know, I mean, they all do horrible things, or all the factory farmers anyway do horrible things, but even if a farmer had done something, you know, more individually vicious to, say, some chickens or some pigs or something like that, they probably wouldn't go to jail at all. They'd probably get a small fine and, no custodial sentence. So I think it is because it's dogs, and because that Michael Vick is going to go to prison at all. But the brevity of the sentence, I just think, shows again the attitude that we have to animals, that they don't really count that much. You know, yes, he stepped over some line certainly, but It's nothing like as serious as inflicting a similar amount of pain and suffering on humans.
Yes, and it would strike me that for those who have a meat-based diet, it would be in conflict, even if they have a dog, but they have a meat-based diet, it would be in conflict if they had to give a stiffer penalty to Michael Vick, because then, of course, if they give dogs that much respect and reverence, and then why not all other animals? And so if they have a meat-based diet, that's just not going to fly. There's a conflict there.
I think, I mean, people do try and keep, you know, dogs, as I was saying, separate from the animals that they eat, but it becomes difficult for people to do that. I mean, I've been involved with an animal group called Animal Rights International, which is exactly trying to make that point. We have been distributing postcards with a picture of a pig and a picture of a child, saying, you know, sorry, and a picture of a picture of postcard and a picture of a dog. A picture of a piglet and a picture of a dog, and there's a child in the background, and we're saying, which do you pet and which do you eat? To get that message across that we have these radically different attitudes to the animals that we pet and the animals that we eat. But in terms of the nature of those animals, you know, their capacity to suffer, their abilities to relate to each other, they're often very similar. There's really no difference.
And if we, even when we have pets, we have the right to take them to the vet and put them down if we see fit. It strikes me that why is there no protection for an animal? Maybe the animal still got a viable life in front of it, but for whatever reason, the owner is saying, nah, not dealing with it anymore. Let's go put the animal down. What do you think about that?
Well, I have to say, I wouldn't want to change that too drastically. I mean, perhaps what you're suggesting is that there should be some independent review of the idea that the animal actually is sick. But I'm an advocate of euthanasia for humans as well. That is, I think that if I get cancer and I'm terminally ill and I don't want to go on living out the last month or two of my life, I want to be able to say to my doctor, look, I've had enough. My quality of life has fallen to a point where it's not worth going on to the very end, so please help me to die. And I think the doctor should be able to give me a lethal injection on my request. Now, the problem with taking your pet to the vet is, of course, the request doesn't come from the pet. The request comes from the pet's owner, and that can be a problem. But if in fact the owner genuinely has the best interest of the animal at heart, then I have no problem at all. I think that it's ridiculous for either a dog or for me to have to live out to the bitter end until I die of natural causes when you can see that that's coming and there's nothing much except suffering between, you know, when you can see it's coming and when it actually does come.
That's true. Now, in Victoria, we have a rabbit problem that's happened on, they call it a rabbit problem, it's happened on the university grounds. There's just bunnies everywhere, and they're multiplying rapidly, and they've had to put fences up to protect some of the unusual species of plants that they have. The rabbits are digging underneath, getting in there anyways, and now they are extending out from the grounds of the university into residential areas, and the people are getting upset about that, and so there's talk of in the rabbit population as opposed to maybe picking them up and moving them somewhere. What do you think about this? Should we have the right to cull?
Well, I have to tell you that picking them up and moving them somewhere is not likely to be a very practical solution. I mean, I'm from Australia. In fact, I'm from the other Victoria, the state of Victoria. You know, there is a huge rabbit problem. Rabbits reproduce quite fast if they get in a good environment with no predators. And, you know, it's not actually possible to pick them up and move them. Now, that doesn't mean that I advocate killing them. In Australia, when I was living there, for a long time I have been advocating that we develop effective ways of preventing them breeding by, you know, putting out baits that contain contraceptive or sterilizing agents, and that seems to me to be a more humane solution than killing them. But you know, I mean, the scientists haven't actually worked on that because killing them has generally been cheaper. But that's what I would like to see happen in these situations. Otherwise, I would hope that maybe people can just live with them. I mean, you know, fence off what you need, what you want to protect, or if you want to grow veggies or something. But otherwise, do your best to live with them.
Yeah.
You know, wild animals running around your property. I mean, in Princeton, we have deer that come around, and some people find them a bit of a nuisance too, because, You know, they will eat your veggies if you're growing veggies too, and you need a quite high fence to keep the deer out. But I think it's wonderful having wild animals sort of sharing your habitat. It shows that, you know, we're not doing everything wrong, at least, if we can keep a habitat that provides sustenance for some wild animals.
This is true, and certainly a lot of the students and faculty at the university here love the rabbits. They've been interviewed. They said, no, we keep them around. We love them. And it probably does change the attitude a little bit towards animals to just say, you know, let them have their space. This is our space, but we share it with them. You know, it's not like it's our space and they can't be here. Do you think that are you a vegan or vegetarian yourself?
I think I shall answer yes to that question. I'm a vegan when I'm sort of shopping and cooking for myself. I'm a bit more flexible when I travel or when others are cooking for me, and I'm sort of generally a vegetarian in those circumstances. Difficult to survive as a vegan, and some places not that easy, then I'll be a bit flexible. Correct, yeah.
Yes. And do you think that our bodies are not designed to eat meat? And do you think it's also unethical to eat meat?
I think by eating meat, you're contributing to or supporting the suffering of animals. And that's generally true if you're... I don't think there's anything unethical about eating meat in itself. I mean, if you came across a deer that had been killed by a car and it was reasonably fresh and you wanted to eat it, you know, well, I mean, I see nothing wrong with that rather than just letting it rot. Now, you know, personally, I haven't eaten meat for 35 years. I don't know that I'd actually have any taste for doing it. But it's not the eating of meat that's unethical, in my view. It's what we do to animals in order to turn them into meat, cheapest possible price in a market economy, that is the real problem.
And what about feeding our pets? Because obviously they're carnivores, and so the animals are... we've got to be in order to feed our pets.
Yeah, when you say it's true of cats, undoubtedly. Dogs can do quite well on a vegetarian diet. So I don't think you need to feed dogs meat, and there are kinds of vegetarian dog foods that you can get that they will thrive on, as well as, of course, you know, most people who have dogs know that they will sort of eat up whatever you put on the floor from your dinner, and that even if you're a vegetarian, they're still going to often eat up your veggies or potatoes or whatever quite happily. With cats, it's more difficult that there are some people who do have vegetarian or vegan cats using special supplements. You need to give them taurine, which is an amino acid that they normally get from meat. I think it's quite difficult, actually, and you know, I certainly would understand people with cats who don't want to do that. You know, that's a question about whether we should have cats, I have to say. You know, given that you have to buy meat for them or buy fish for them, there are other animals that make good companions that are vegetarians, and maybe that's a better way to go.
But then, what would we do with all the domesticated?
No, we certainly shouldn't send them out of the wild because they're predators and they're going to start killing wildlife, and they could endanger species of wildlife when they get into that area. No, I mean, I think we have cats, obviously. We have to feed them what they need, but I mean, the question is whether we should allow them to reproduce and continue to have more cats, which are also going to be carnivores, which are also going to require us to feed them. I think that's... that's an ethical issue which animal organizations often don't like to discuss because a lot of their supporters are people who have cats and who love cats and care about cats. And I can understand that. I think they're wonderful animals in many ways. There is this problem about what they eat.
And how does... do you think there's a connection between our treatment of animals and our treatment of women?
Oh, that's been alleged by some feminist movement. I mean, look, I'm not too sure about that one, I have to say. You know, I think that there are some plausible arguments made, but I'm not really sure how much of a connection there is.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've noticed, and I know I've spoken about on the show too, is the amount of names that are used to animal names that are used to women, you know, some cow, nag, sow, bitch, in a variety of names I won't even say, fox, chick, you know, a variety of names I won't say on the air. And it seems to me that once the attitude is that we've dehumanized them, we've now reduced them to the level of animal, then it then to degrade and abuse and control and treat them in a less than human way once they've been referred to that way. And that's my observation, for what it's worth. And so I thought if we make some effort, those of us who are using animal names to describe women or even people, that if we make some effort to stop doing this, change our attitude towards women by doing so. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes some sense, and exactly. Well, I'm glad you added as well as animals, because of course when we use words like cow or bitch or whatever as a term of abuse, that is demeaning to animals. Well, we think that it's bad to be like a cow or like a female dog. I mean, you know, they're special creatures. They're different from us in some ways, but they have their own characteristics. So we should not use animal names as terms of insult anyway.
That's true. To back up for a second, we were talking about, the deers that come into, rabbits that come here. Sometimes here we have bears or even a cougar or foxes or whatever that come in and enter a residential area, and it's a big surprise to everybody. And so whether the animal has attacked a human or not, an uproar happens and they go and they hunt this animal down and they kill big heroes for having done so, because now everybody is protected from pain or death. What do you think about doing that sort of thing?
Look, I think that, as we were saying before, we have to try and live with animals, and I think we should, do our best to be able to live with them in a non-violent way. And I think people are starting, to realize, well, there may be the occasional wild animal that is just too dangerous to live with, and I can usually that's not the case. We can adjust to them. And, even seeing them or killing them doesn't do a lot of good, because after all, there'll be others that will replace them. So it's a matter of finding a way to do that. I'm very impressed by the story, as I've already mentioned. I'm Australian. I know an Australian eco-feminist, a woman who's written eloquently about the importance of nature and having harmonious relationships with nature, who herself was paddling a canoe on a river in Australia's Northern Territory when the canoe was overturned by a crocodile, which grabbed her in the water and tried to, crocodiles, kill their prey. And she's one of the very few people who has been grabbed by a crocodile and rolled underwater and has lived to tell the tale. Roots of a tree that was just by the bank there, and struggled, and eventually the crocodile gave up. And although she was very badly bitten, she crawled up the bank and could call for help and was rushed to hospital. And she recovered. And, of course, after that happened, the first people were saying, well, tell us where it is, we'll go out and shoot that croc. And she said, no, the croc had the right to be there. The crocs have been in that river for millions of years. I was the one who was out of place, just leave it alone. And I think that's, that's the right attitude to have, really.
I agree with you, too. I've been shocked when I've seen the stories, when they've had captive elephants. They put these little, riding cages on the top of them and send them around in circles with people riding their backs, and eventually the elephants go berserk and they've had enough of this, and they bolt out and they think the animal's gone mad, and then at least that's the justification for going out and now shooting and killing an elephant. And I've witnessed or seen this on TV and heard about it a number of times, and it always makes me feel sick, because I think we put it in this situation, made it walk around in circles. Well, of course, if they did that to me, I'd go berserk too, and then go and shoot the animal and feel like a hero afterwards. There's something really wrong with our psyches that we are okay with that.
Yes, well, that's true. And as you say, the problem begins with our confinement of the animal, of the elephant, and our using it just as a thing to amuse kids or even adults going for rides on. I mean, that's a thing, whether the elephant then does go berserk and it's killed, or whether it doesn't. I mean, it's a miserable life for a magnificent animal. Animals in the wild are living with groups and so on. I think it's just an awful thing to do.
With all these things going on with animals, do you think that human beings are, that there's something, I would have to say especially men, that there's something, a love of violence, that they go out and they do these things?
I think that some men have a love of that, every one of my sex, but I think some of them do. It's triggered in particular circumstances, right? So you might have people who in one set of social circumstances would live out a peaceful, happy life with their family, but then they got put together with a whole lot of other men and drilled on, how horrible the enemy is and how dangerous they are, and then their weapons, and that will bring all of this violence to the surface. Tragically, we've been seeing that in Iraq all the time. We see it, if you've been following the inquiry into the killings by the Blackwater private security company in Iraq, it seems like that's the kind of culture, and maybe it attracts those men particularly for that sort of job, that they want to have the opportunity to kill someone. They're sort of itching for it. It does seem that happens to men in particular circumstances. I mean, you might put an army of 100,000 people into Iraq, and maybe most of them will actually abide by the rules of combat, but you will certainly get a definite number who will kill civilians, and we've seen it with some of the trials of army personnel, and I suspect we see it with the private security companies as well.
Do you think that attitude, that destructive attitude, plays out, though, in a lesser form in some animal activists?
In animal activists, you're talking about people who burn down labs or something like that?
Exactly, yes.
Well, look, I don't really, no, I would resist that comparison, because although I don't approve of people burning down labs or actions like that, in fact, you have to recognize that the animal movement has been extraordinarily careful to avoid actually, killing or even seriously injuring human beings, as well as animals, of course. So although there have been a lot of actions that the media like to call violent because they are destroying labs or buildings or something of that sort, the number that have actually injured people is really tiny. I mean, I think there's been one person who was killed in England and one or two others who were injured, but considering what a big movement this is worldwide with many millions of members, it compares very favorably to the so-called pro-life movement, the anti-abortion movement, which has been responsible for the killing of several doctors carrying out abortions in the United States. I wouldn't sort of tar them with the same brush. Although, as I say, I think their actions are misguided, and I don't support them. I don't think it's just it's not the same kind of bloodlust that we sometimes see in wars and similar kinds of occasions.
No, that's true, and that's why I said to a lesser degree. I have noticed that it can be an ego trip for some people, but then you can say that about any activity in any industry and anything. I mean, that's something that people have to guard against, is their own ego and their feeling of superiority. I'm an animal activist. I'm superior to those people who just aren't in the know about compassion for animals and all that sort of thing. We have to guard against that, because it strikes me that self-centeredness and ego is at the root of a lot of these problems. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think we are, a fairly self-centered species, really. I suppose inevitably that's, there's some inevitability about that. If we have evolved through the selection of those who manage to survive and have children and help their children to survive, then there's bound to be a certain element of self-centeredness. Yes, we have to be aware of that, and we have to try and work with that to produce the best possible outcomes.
And I want to talk some more about that. Let me just take a station break here. You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's Co-op Radio. My name is Allart. The show is Animal Voices, and I'm interviewing Peter Singer, who's most well known for his book Animal Liberation. And so we're talking about animal activism. On the subject of self-centeredness, again, it strikes me that if one allows himself to feel superior in any way, if they do not guard against that, that it is inevitable that they are going to harm another. It seems to go hand in hand, the idea of feeling of superiority and of harming. And then it strikes me that the only way to counteract that is to do everything one can to reduce their ego and to develop some humility. Would you agree with that?
I don't actually agree that seeing yourself as superior necessarily means that you're going to harm others. No, I think, you know, I mean, I certainly favor an egalitarian society, but I can think of people, you know, some traditional aristocrats, say, in England, who may well have seen themselves as superior, but were nevertheless kind of benign towards those they regarded as their inferiors. Now, it may have been a kind of paternalistic attitude that they had, but I wouldn't necessarily say that it involves them harming them.
That's true. I have to acknowledge that point. I guess I'm just seeing a dysfunctional part of what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Since your book Animal Liberation in 1975, could you tell us what was happening with the animal rights movement when that book first was published, and what the changes are that you've seen since then?
What was happening with the animal rights movement when the book was first published?
Yeah.
There wasn't any animal rights movement. The animal rights movement just didn't exist at that time. There was a kind of animal welfare movement, like the SPCA's and the Humane Society, but nobody was talking about rights or animal liberation. When I say nobody, there might have been, you know, tiny organizations that nobody had ever heard of that were existing, but you know, all the big organizations, the radical organizations now, like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, they were only founded some years after the book was published. And in fact, partly inspired by the book to take the view that they did. So, you know, what we've seen over those 30 odd years since the book was published is the growth of an entirely new radical movement with a really substantially different philosophy from the one that had existed up to that time. And we've seen animals become a kind of a public issue in a way that was really unimaginable in the early 70s, when there was, of course, people were concerned about cruelty to dogs and cats and maybe to horses, but there was no movement against factory farming. Most people hadn't even heard of factory farming, though it certainly was already existing. But there were no attempts to change conditions there. There was a small anti-vivisection movement, but not a single experiment had ever actually been stopped because of protests from any anti-vivisectionists at that time. That only began to happen later. There was no thought of developing alternatives to animals and the use of animals in experiments, because there was no pressure to do so, and that was just the way in which scientists had been educated and trained, so they just automatically used animals without thinking really about what alternatives there might be. It's really a completely different picture today.
And do you think that improvements will continue? I mean, there seems to be a train going in either direction, one where there have been all of these improvements, but then there is an increase, you know, in the dog fighting, in the, dare I say it, bestiality, you know, in a variety of abuses that perhaps...
Is there an increase in bestiality or dog fighting? I mean, how do we know? These have been, illegal activities. It's very hard to get statistics on them. It's quite possible, I think, that there's just been a bit more publicity and a bit more attention paid to them, and not really that there's been an increase in it.
Oh, well, you may be right about that. I mean, I've seen just recently, which I was fairly stunned to see. I guess it was sort of put out, a film that was sort of put out as being a semi-documentary, but it was regarding a case that had come out in Washington. It was a bestiality case, and they were with a horse and a man who had ended up dying because of his...
Yeah, but I mean, do you imagine that didn't happen much before? In fact, I've seen surveys that suggest it was far more common that I've seen surveys, I think, that in the 50s or maybe earlier, One in three male farmhands admitted having had sexual contact with animals. Now, you know, I mean, it's kind of understandable. You know, to be blunt, it was harder to get sex with a girl, I guess, unless you married her, right? I mean, there was more of a feeling. There wasn't an effective contraceptive, so I guess, you know, males who hung around farm animals didn't have too many alternatives. But I think that there was probably a lot more sexual interference with farm animals, you know, sort of 50 years ago than there is today.
Well, that could be. I know that this film, and the thing that concerns me is that this film came out and it was, they tried to describe it as, you know, sort of hauntingly beautiful, and I mean, it kind of made me sick, you know, that they would describe it in this fashion. And I could not help wonder if, because I work in the film industry too, and I've seen the you know, over the years, about more and more gratuitous sex violence, you know, all for shock value. And there are things you see on the screen these days that you did not see on the screen 20, 30 years ago, that would be just too offensive for people, and now it's just taken for granted, and it's become normalized. And I dread the idea that somebody might, in the future, try to introduce bestiality or something for the sake of shock value, and heaven forbid that there should be some kind of acceptance of this behavior.
Yes, but I have to say I'm more disturbed by the violence. You know, I don't like to see violent movies. I don't like to see violence on the screen. I don't think it does any good. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that troubles me, I have to say, most.
What are the things that are on your mind these days that you think are important to discuss with regards to animals?
I think the crucial issue that is unfolding in North America generally, let's say, is the treatment of farm animals. We have lagged far behind Europe on that issue. When I say we, I mean both the United States and Canada have lagged far behind Europe in terms of protection of farm animals. The entire European Union, you know, 25 nations stretching from Poland to Spain, and from, you know, the other direction, I guess, from Greece to Sweden or somewhere, has passed legislation that is going to phase out the standard battery cage for hens as we know it, to give hens a lot more room, to give them the ability to lay their eggs in sheltered nesting boxes. They're getting rid of gestation crates for pregnant sows, which confine pregnant pigs so that they can't move or walk around at all for, you know, really pretty much for all of their lives, because they're pregnant for most of their lives. They're making the veal crate illegal, which again confines veal calves for all of their fairly short lives in conditions where they can't walk or turn around, just kept in narrow stalls. So we have, you know, we have billions of animals in terrible conditions here, and we haven't really got any legislation to stop that. So I think we need to face up to this, and we need either to get a change in consumers so they're not buying these products, they're demanding more humanely raised animal products if they eat animal products at all, or we need to get legislation. And I'm hopeful that this is starting to happen. In the United States, we had a couple of victories in citizen-initiated referenda in Florida and Arizona, and now some of the big groups are trying to get an initiative up in California to ban the battery cage as well as to ban sow crates and veal crates. I think that would be fantastic if it happened, and I hope that other states and Canada would also then follow suit.
Yes, and I think we have a municipality, I think, of Richmond that they outlawed factory-farmed eggs. Did they not, Carl?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, yeah, and I think some of the other municipalities are also starting to follow that lead. Apparently also because we're having the 2010 Olympics here, and three of the Olympic venues, is it Whistler, Richmond, and Vancouver or Burnaby? Anyways, one of the other venues, they have endorsed certified organic eggs, and said that they want people to just say it's certified. So this is coming from the Olympic
That's great. Well, that's very good. And, you know, similar sorts of things are happening in the States, too, because a lot of university campuses, for example, have now moved to serving only eggs from hens that are not kept in cages. I'm delighted to say that my own university, Princeton, recently made this decision. But it's, you know, it's joined or sort of 60 or I don't know how many it is now, it might even be 80 or 100 campuses that have made a similar decision. So I'd certainly encourage, you know, any of your listeners who are either students or academic faculty to think about that question, to think about what kind of animal product is my institution serving and what can I do to get them to, you know, lead the way by setting humane standards for the raising of the animals whose products they serve.
And how would you suggest that we counteract, you know, there's big corporate business with the burger food chains and the junk food commercials, and they're all targeting children and trying to get them hooked on this stuff at an early age. How would you say we combat that? I mean, they got big bucks behind all of that.
Of course, they've got huge advertising budgets, but they are vulnerable to consumer pressure for more, you know, at least more humanely produced animal products, even if, and perhaps also to introduce a veggie burger or something like that. And, you know, a lot of groups have been doing that. This group I mentioned that I'm involved with, Animal Rights International, has been doing that for a long time, actually, back into the early 1980s, I think. It started doing that with McDonald's, and there's been a little bit of progress. I mean, there's a long way to go, but I think McDonald's has set standards for the hens that lay its eggs. Unfortunately, not cage-free, but at least slightly larger cages than was the standard in the U.S. So, you know, if with a giant like McDonald's, even if they shift an inch, that can make a difference. So I think that's what we need to do. We need to keep up the pressure on them. We need to be saying, you know, if you want to hold your heads up as a respectable corporation, you've got to set ethical standards for how animals are raised before they end up as products in your restaurants.
Yeah, some of them may not care about holding their heads up high. I think some of them seem to be.
Well, I mean, in fact, that's not quite right, at least for the big ones. You know, I'd say McDonald's, Burger King, they've been responsive on this issue.
Do you think that's because of compassion or just because they think that's a better business idea?
I don't care, frankly. I really don't care. I mean, they will only think it's a better business idea if they think their consumers care about it. So whether, you know, whether some guy in the boardroom cares about it or whether he says, hey, our consumers care about this, for the sake of our business, we better do something about it, as long as the animals benefit, I really don't care what the motive is.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about, I mean, the school systems, they seem to be slowly changing. I don't know what they're like. I guess on Wednesday I have another program called Dynamic Health, and I interviewed, I don't know if you know, Dr. Antonia Demas, who has managed to introduce plant-based diets in over 1,000 schools in 28 states and get kids interested in choosing healthier plant-based foods over junk foods and that sort of thing, and has some creative ways of teaching children. And so she's getting them when they're young. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not, actually, but it sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, because that certainly would change the kids' attitudes towards animal at a very early age and help to counteract, again, that big advertising push to get kids into the burger chains. Yes, we have about 5 minutes left in the show. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about what you think is important that we know before we end the show today.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, you know, this is a big area. We've had a whole hour, so we've done pretty well in covering a lot of it. Of course, there's a lot of other issues relating to animals apart from the farm animals, but I focused on that because that is by far the biggest in terms of numbers. I mean, it absolutely dwarfs the number of animals used in any other area of animal abuse, which is why I focus on it. But I do want to link it in, perhaps, if we got a few more minutes, with environmental questions, because I think that clearly that's important. And, you know, there's a lot of meetings going on around the world right now about climate change. And this is clearly an issue that involves animals, too. If climate changes, a lot of animals are going to be unable to cope. They're not going to be able to move anywhere. We've all seen the sort of image of the polar bear on thin ice, which I guess is something which resonates with Canadians particularly, but you know, that's one iconic species that will be in terrible trouble. But there are you know, thousands of other species and hundreds of millions of individual animals that will die, or perhaps are already dying because of droughts induced by climate change and things of that sort. So I think that this is a tremendously important issue for both animals and humans, and for future generations for hundreds or perhaps thousands of years to come, that that we all should be aware of, and we should all be putting as much pressure as we possibly can on our political leaders to say, you've got to get serious about this. You can't just go on talking and twiddling your thumbs while we go on, you know, emitting huge amounts of greenhouse gases. And unfortunately, both the United States and Canada, and Australia for that matter, are, have some of the highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions in the world. And there's no point in saying, you know, pointing at China or India or saying, well, you should do something about it, because our greenhouse gas emissions per capita are maybe 5 or 6 times as high as China's and 10 or 15 times as high as India's. So really, we're the ones who should be taking the lead. And I hope that people understand that and the political leaders understand it.
What can we do individually to help that?
Well, individually, we can play our own small roles, I guess, by trying to reduce our own carbon footprint. I mean, we can try not to drive. It will depend on your circumstances, you know, whether you can walk or take public transport or cycle or something of that sort. But if you do drive, to try and drive a fuel-efficient car, to, you know, get a hybrid like the Prius or something like that when next you change your car, those things all help. To you know, not have the air conditioning on too high, and conversely to not have the heating on too high in winter. All of those kinds of things help on an individual basis. But we do need global political solutions. And so, you know, writing to your parliamentary representative and talking about this and saying that, you know, this is one of the issues that you're really concerned with is also going to make a difference, I think.
True. And we have just a couple of minutes left. What to, oh, I'm getting past a note here. What is it? Oh, do you want to give your web page, Peter?
Well, if people just put my name into Google, actually, they will just put Peter Singer in quotes into Google. They'll get my web page is a Princeton web page that I run, and that has you know, certain information about me and links to. They will also get another website that is has a lot of articles by me that you can access online. And I'd also like to mention, I've mentioned Animal Rights International. If people want to know more about what we're doing, it's a small organization, but it's one that I've that I'm actually president of, although unfortunately I don't have time to do as much. So so it's ARI hyphen online. So it's ARI hyphen ONLINE dot ORG. And they can have a look at what we're doing. And if people want to support that as well, that's great. And you can see that I talked about that poster or postcard with the cat and the pig, you know, and we have a couple of those and things like that. And if you want to pick up my, you mentioned the book about stem cells, but more relevant to this, I guess, is a book I wrote with Jim Mason, another animal activist, called The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. And you can order that through the website. In fact, there's now a paperback where they changed the title. The title now is called The Ethics of What We Eat, but it's basically the same book. And you can get it on other online bookstores as well, of course.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to all of us. And hopefully we can have you on again in the future and get some updates on what you're doing.
Okay. Thanks, Art.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Okay, take care. Goodbye. You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's co-op radio. My name is Allart. I've been interviewing Peter Singer about his work with animal rights and ethics. And the show you've been listening to is called Animal Voices. And we'll be back next week. Oh, don't forget to go check out the Taste of Health show that's coming up this weekend, the 29th and 30th. It's put on by EarthSave. It's their annual Healthy Food and Lifestyle Festival. There are some great speakers that will be there. It's a book fair, cooking demonstrations, vendors. It's a great, great fun and a lot to learn. If you want more information about it, go to earthsave.ca. By the way, it'll be at the Croatian Cultural Center, which is at 16th and Commercial. So I encourage you to get out there and learn more and find out what's going, what the latest things are in these fields. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week.
Just coming up to 12:58, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll have Radio EcoShock to